Chapter 11. Vera had meant to stay awake to see them off, but she had fallen asleep by the fire, and the soft knock at the door did not waken her. South Wind and Luge looked at each other. South Wind shook her head. Luge knelt and hastily, as silently as she could, laid a fresh square of peat behind the coals so the house would stay warm through the night. South Wind, made awkward by her heavy coat and backpack, stooped and touched Vera's gray hair with her lips. Then she looked around the house, a bewildered, hurried look, and went out. Luge followed her. The night was cloudy but dry, very dark. The cold of it woke Luge from her long trance of waiting, and she caught her breath. There were people around her in the dark, a few soft voices.
"Both there? All right, come on."
They set off past the house, through the potato field, toward the low ridge that lay behind it to the east. As Luge's eyes became accustomed to the dark, she made out that the person who walked beside her was Lev's father, Sasha. Sensing her gaze in the darkness, he said, "How's the pack?"
"It's all right," she said in a bare whisper.
They must not talk, they must not make any noise, she thought, not yet, not till they were clear of the settlement. Past the last village and the last farm, across Mill River, a long way. They must go fast and silently and not be stopped. Oh, Lord God, please not be stopped.
"Mine's made of iron ingots or unforgiven sins," Sasha murmured,
and they went on in silence, a dozen shadows in the shadow of the world. It was still dark when they came to Mill River, a few kilometers south of where it joined the Songe. The boat was waiting, Andre and Holdfast waiting with it. Hari rowed six across, then the second six. Luge was in the second lot. As they neared the eastern shore, the solid blackness of the night world was growing insubstantial, a veil of light dimming all things, a mist thickening on the water. Shivering, she set foot on the far shore. Left alone in the boat, which Andre and the others had already pushed off again, Hari called out softly,
"Good luck, good luck. Peace go with you."
And the boat vanished into the mist like a ghost, and the 12 stood there on the ghostly, fading sand.
"Up this way," said Andre's voice out of the mist and pallor. "They'll have breakfast for us."
They were the last and smallest of the three groups to leave, one group a night. The others were waiting farther on among the rugged hills east of the mill, country where only coney trappers went. In single file, following Andre and Holdfast, they left the riverbank and set off into the wild land. She had been thinking for hours and hours, step after step, that as soon as they stopped, she would sink right down on the dirt or the mud or the sand, sink down and not move again till morning. But when they stopped, she saw Martin and Andre up at the front discussing something, and she went on, step after step, till she came up with them, and even then did not sink down, but kept standing to hear what they were talking about.
"Martin thinks the compass isn't reading true," Andre said.
With a dubious look, he held the instrument out to Luge, as if she could judge its accuracy at a glance. What she saw was its delicacy. The box of polished wood, the gold ring, the glass, the frail burnished needle hovering, trembling between the finely incised points. What a beautiful thing, miraculous, improbable, she thought. But Martin was looking at it with disapproval.
"I'm sure it's pulling east," he said. "It must be iron ore masses in those hills, deflecting it."
He nodded toward the east. For a day and a half, they had been in a queer, scrubby country that bore no ring trees or cotton wools, but only a sparse, tangled scrub, which grew no more than a couple of meters high. It was not forest, but not open country. There was seldom any long view. But they knew that to the east, to their left, the line of high hills they had first seen 6 days ago went on. Whenever they came up on a rise in the scrublands, they saw the dark red, rocky skyline of the heights.
"Well," Luge said, hearing her own voice for the first time in hours,
"does it matter much?"
Andre chewed his lower lip. His face looked bone-weary, the eyes narrowed and lifeless. "Not for going on," he said, "so long as we have the sun or some stars at night. But for making the map, what if we turn east again, get over those hills? They aren't getting any lower," Martin said. A younger man than Andre, he looked far less tired. He was one of the mainstays of the group. Luge felt at ease with Martin. He looked like a city man, stocky, dark, well-muscled, rather curt and somber. Even his name was a common one in the city. But for all Martin's comfortable strength, it was to Andre that she turned with her question.
"Can't we mark the trail yet?"
Unwilling to make any trail that could be followed, they had tried to map their course. A map could be brought back to Shanti by a few messengers, after a couple of years, to guide a second group to the new colony. That was the only reason for making it that they ever spoke of. Andre, the map maker of the northern journey, was in charge of it, and he felt his responsibility as a heavy one, for the unspoken purpose of the map was always in their minds. It was their one link to Shanti, to humankind, to their own past lives, their one assurance that they were not simply wandering lost in the wilderness, aimless, without goal, and, since they could mark no trail, without hope of return. At times, Luge clung to the idea of the map. At times, she was impatient with it. Martin was keen on it, but his keenest care was that they keep their trail covered. He winced, Italia remarked, when anybody stepped on a stick and broke it. Certainly they had left, in the 10 days of their journey, as little mark of their going as 67 people could leave. Martin was shaking his head at Luge's question. "Look," he said, "our choice of route has been so obvious, the easiest way right from the start." Andre smiled. It was a dry crack of a smile, like a crack in tree bark, and narrowed his eyes to two lesser cracks. That was why Luge liked to be with Andre, drew strength from him, that humorous, patient smile, like a tree smiling. "Consider the options, Martin," he said, and she saw what he was imagining. A party of city men, Macmillan's bullies, guns and whips and boots and all, standing on the bluffs of the Songe, looking north, east, south, over the gray, rusty-ringed, rising, falling, rain-darkened, unending, trackless, voiceless, enormous wilderness, and trying to decide which of 100 possible directions the fugitives had chosen. "All right," she said. "Let's cross the hills, then."
"Climbing won't be much harder than slogging through this scrub," Andre said.
Martin nodded.
"Turn east again here, then."
"Here as well as anywhere," said Andre,
and got out his grubby, dog-eared sketch map to make a note.
"Now?" Luge asked. "Or camp?"
They usually did not camp till near sundown, but they had come a long way today. She looked around the shoulder-high, thorny, bronze-colored bushes, which grew spaced a meter or two apart so that millions of pointless, winding trails led around and between and amongst them. Only a few of the group were visible. Most of them had sat right down to rest when the halt was called. Overhead was a lead-gray sky, featureless, one even cloud. No rain had fallen for 2 nights, but the weather was getting colder every hour.
"Well, a few more kilos," Andre said, "and we'd be at the foot of the hills. Might find some shelter there. And water."
He looked at her judgingly and waited for her judgment. He, Martin, Italia, the other pathfinders, often used her and a couple of the older women as representatives of the weak, the ones who could not keep the pace the strongest would have kept. She didn't mind. She walked each day right to the limit of her endurance or beyond it. The first 3 days of the journey, when they had been hurrying, afraid of pursuit, had exhausted her, and though she was growing tougher, she never could make up that initial loss. She accepted this and saved all her resentment for her backpack, that monstrous and irascible, knee-bending, neck-destroying load. If only they didn't have to carry everything with them.
but they could not push carts without making or leaving paths, and 67 people could not live off the wilderness while traveling or settle in it without tools, even if it were not late autumn getting on to winter.
"A few more kilos," she said. She was always surprised when she said things like that. "A few more kilos," as if it were nothing at all, when for the last 6 hours she had longed, craved to sit down, just to sit down, just to sit down for a minute, a month, a year. But now they had spoken of turning east again, she found she also craved to get out of this dreary maze of thorn scrub into the hills, where maybe you could see your way ahead.
"Few minutes rest," she added, and sat down, slipping off her pack straps and rubbing her aching shoulders. Andre promptly sat down too. Martin went off to talk with some of the others and discuss the change of course. None of them was visible. They had all vanished in the sea of thorn scrub, taking their few minutes' rest already, flat out on the sandy, grayish soil littered with thorns. She could not even see Andre, only a corner of his pack. A northwest wind, faint but cold, rustled the little dry branches of the bushes. There was no other sound. 67 people, no sight of them, no sound of them, vanished. Lost. A drop of water in the river, a word blown off on the wind. Some small creatures moved a little while in the wilderness, not going very far, and then ceased to move, and it made no difference to the wilderness or to anything, no more difference than the dropping of one thorn among a million thorns, or the shifting of a grain of sand. The fear she had come to know these 10 days of their journeying came up like a small gray fog in the fields of her mind, a chill creep of blindness. It was hers, hers by inheritance and training. It was to keep out her fear, their fear, that the roofs and walls of the city had been raised. It was fear that had drawn the streets so straight and made the doors so narrow. She had scarcely known it, living behind those doors. She had felt quite safe. Even in Shanti she had forgotten it, stranger as she was, for the walls there were not visible but were very strong. Companionship, cooperation, love, the close human circle. But she had walked away from that by choice, and walked out into the wilderness, and come face to face at last with the fear that all her life had been built upon. She could not simply face it, but had to fight it when it first began to come upon her, or it would blot out everything and she would lose the power of choice entirely. She had to fight blindly, for no reason stood against that fear. It was a great deal older and stronger than ideas. There was the idea of God. Back in the city they talked about God to children. He made all the worlds, and he punished the wicked and sent good people up to heaven when they died. Heaven was a beautiful house with a gold roof where Maria, God's mother, everybody's mother, tenderly waited for the souls of the dead. She had liked that story. When she was little, she had prayed to God to make things happen and not happen because he could do anything if you asked him. Later, she had liked to imagine God's mother and her mother keeping house together. But when she thought of heaven here, it was small and far away, like the city. It had nothing to do with the wilderness. There was no God here. He belonged to people, and where there were no people, there was no God. At the funeral for Lev and the others, they had talked about God too, but that was back there. Back there. Here, there was nothing like that. Nobody had made this wilderness, and there was no evil in it, and no good. It simply was. She drew a circle in the sandy dirt near her foot, making it as perfect as she could, using a thorny twig to draw it with. That was a world, or a self, or God, that circle. You could call it anything. Nothing else in the wilderness could think of a circle like that. She thought of the delicate gold ring around the compass glass. Because she was human, she had the mind and eyes and skillful hand to imagine the idea of a circle and to draw the idea. But any drop of water falling from a leaf into a pool or rain puddle could make a circle, a more perfect one,
fleeting outward from the center, and if there were no boundary to the water, the circle would fleet outward forever, fainter and fainter, forever larger. She could not do that, which any drop of water could do. Inside her circle, what was there? Grains of sand, dust, a few tiny pebbles, a half-buried thorn. Andre's tired face, the sound of South Wind's voice, Sasha's eyes, which were like Lev's eyes, the ache of her own shoulders where the pack straps pulled, and her fear. The circle could not keep out the fear. And the hand erased the circle, smoothing out the sand, leaving it as it had always been and would always be after they had gone on.
At first, I felt that I was leaving Timo behind, South Wind said, as she studied the worst blister on her left foot. When we left the house, he and I built it, you know. I felt as if I was walking away and finally leaving him forever, leaving him behind. But now it doesn't seem that way. It was out here he died, in the wilderness. Not here, I know, way back up north there. But I don't feel that he's so terribly far away as I did all autumn living in our house. It's almost as if I'd come out to join him. Not dying, I don't mean that. It's just that there I only thought about his death. And here, while we're walking, all the time, I think about him alive, as if he was with me now. They had camped in a fold of the land just under the Red Hills, beside a lively, rocky stream. They had built their fires, cooked and eaten. Many were already stretched out in their blankets to sleep. It was not dark yet, but so cold that if you weren't moving about, you must either huddle to the fire or wrap up and sleep. The first 5 nights of the journey, they had not built fires for fear of pursuers, and those had been miserable nights. Luge had never known such a pure delight as she had felt at their first campfire, back in a great tree ring on the south slope of the Badlands. And every night that pleasure came again, the utter luxury of hot food, of warmth. The three families she and South Wind camped and cooked with were settling down for the night. The youngest child, the youngest of the whole migration, a boy of 11, was curled up like a pouch bat in his blanket already, fast asleep. Luge tended the fire, while South Wind tended her blisters. Up and down the riverbank were 7 other fires, the farthest no more than a candle flame in the blue-gray dusk, a spot of hazy, trembling gold. The noise of the stream covered any sound of voices round the other fires. "I'll get some more brushwood," Luge said. She was not avoiding an answer to what South Wind had said. No answer was needed. South Wind was gentle and complete. She gave and spoke, expecting no return. In all the world, there could be no companion less demanding or more encouraging. They had done a good day's walk, 27 kilometers by Martin's estimate. They had got out of that drab nightmare labyrinth of scrub. They had had a hot dinner. The fire was hot and it was not raining. Even the ache in Luge's shoulders was pleasant because the pack was not pulling on them when she stood up. It was these times at the day's end by the fire that counterweighed the long, dreary, hungry afternoons of walking and walking and walking and trying to ease the cut of the pack straps on her shoulders and the hours in the mud and rain when there seemed to be no reason at all to go on and the worst hours in the black dark of the night when she woke always from the same terrible dream that there was a circle of some things, not people, standing around their camp just out of sight, not visible in the darkness, but watching. "This one's better," South Wind said when Luge came back with an armload of wood from the thickets up the slope. "But the one on my heel isn't. You know, all today I've been feeling that we aren't being followed." "I don't think we ever were," Luge said, building up the fire. "I never did think they'd really care, even if they knew. They don't want to think about the wilderness in the city. They want to pretend it isn't there." "I hope so. I hated feeling that we were running. Being explorers is a much
braver feeling. Luj got the fire settled to burning low but warm and squatted by it, simply soaking the heat up for some while.
"I miss Vera," she said. Her throat was dry with the dust of walking, and she did not use her voice often these days. It sounded dry and harsh to her, like her father's voice.
"She'll come with the second group," Southwind said with comfortable certainty, winding a cloth strip around her pretty, battered foot and tying it off firmly at the ankle.
"Ah, that feels better. I'm going to wrap my feet tomorrow like Holdfast does. It'll be warmer, too. If it just won't rain, it won't rain tonight."
The Shanti people were much weather wiser than Luj. They had not lived so much within doors as she. They knew what the wind meant, even here, where the winds were different.
"It might tomorrow," Southwind added, beginning to wriggle into her blanket bag, her voice already sounding small and warm.
"Tomorrow we'll be up in the hills," Luj said. She looked up to the east, but the near slope of the stream valley and the blue-gray dusk hid that rocky skyline. The clouds had thinned. A star shone out for a while, high in the east, small and misty, then vanished as the unseen clouds rejoined. Luj watched for it to reappear, but it did not. She felt foolishly disappointed. The sky was dark now, the ground was dark, no light anywhere, except the 8 gold flecks, their campfires, a tiny constellation in the night. And far off there, days behind them in the west, thousands and thousands of steps behind them, behind the scrubland and the badland and the hills and the valleys and the streams, beside the great river running to the sea, a few more lights, the city and the town, a tiny huddle of yellow-lit windows. The river dark, running in darkness, and no light on the sea. She reset a log to smolder more slowly and banked the ashes against it. She found her sleeping bag and wriggled down into it next to Southwind. She wanted to talk now. Southwind had seldom spoken much of Timo. She wanted to hear her talk about him and about Lev. She wanted, for the first time, to speak about Lev herself. There was too much silence here. Things would get lost in the silence. One should speak. And Southwind would understand. She, too, had lost her luck and known death and gone on. Luj said her name softly, but the warm blanket bundle next to her did not stir. Southwind was asleep. Luj settled down cautiously, getting herself comfortable. The river beach, though stony, was a better bed than last night's in the thorny scrubland, but her body was so tired that it felt heavy, unwieldy, hard. Her chest was hard and tight. She closed her eyes. At once she saw the hall of Casa Falku, long and serene, the silver light reflected from the bay filling the windows, and her father standing there, erect, alert, self-contained, as he always stood. But he was standing there doing nothing, which was not like him. Michael and Teresa were off in the doorway, whispering together. She felt a curious resentment toward them. Her father stood with his back to them as if he did not know they were there, or as if he knew it, but was afraid of them. He raised his arms in a strange way. She saw his face for a moment. He was crying. She could not breathe. She tried to draw a long breath, but could not. It caught, because she was crying. Deep, shaking sobs from which she could scarcely gasp a breath before the next came. Racked with sobs, lying shaken and tormented on the ground in the enormous night, she wept for the dead, for the lost. Not fear now, but grief. The grief past enduring. That endures. Her weariness and the darkness drank her tears, and she fell asleep before she was done weeping. She slept all night without dreams or evil wakings, like a stone among the stones. The hills were high and hard. The uphill going was not bad, for they could zigzag up across the great open, rusty slopes, but when they got to the top, among the rim rock piled like houses and towers, they saw that they had climbed only the first of a triple or quadruple chain of hills, and that the farther ridges were higher. In the canyons between the ridges, ring trees crowded, not growing in rings, but jammed close and shooting up unnaturally high toward the light. The heavy shrub called aloes crowded between the red trunks, making the going very difficult, but there was still fruit on the aloes, thick, rich, dark flesh wrinkled about a center seed, a welcome addition to the scanty food in their packs. In this country, they had no choice but to leave a trail behind them. They had to cut their way with brush hooks to get on at all. They were a day getting through the canyon, another climbing the second line of hills, beyond which lay the next chain of canyons, massed with bronze trees and crimson underbrush, and beyond it a formidable ridge, steep-spurred, rising in bare screes to the rock-capped summit. They had to camp down in the gorge the next night. Even Martin, after cutting and hacking their way forward step by step, by mid-afternoon was too tired to go on. When they camped, those who were not worn out from path-making spread out from the camp, cautiously and not going far, for in the undergrowth you could lose all sense of direction very easily. They found and picked aloes, and several of the boys, led by Welcome, found freshwater mussels in the stream at the bottom of the gorge when they went for water. They had a good meal that night. They needed it, for it was raining again. Mist, rain, evening grayed the heavy, vivid reds of the forest. They built up brushwood shelters and huddled by fires which would not stay alight.
I saw a queer thing, Luge.
He was a strange fellow, Sasha. The oldest of them all, though tough and wiry, better able to keep up than some of the younger men. Never out of temper, totally self-reliant, and almost totally silent. Luge had never seen him take part in a conversation beyond a yes or no, a smile or headshake. She knew he had never spoken at the meeting house, never been one of Elia's group or Vera's people, never been a choice maker among his people, though he was the son of one of their great heroes and leaders, Schultz, who had led the long march from the streets of the city Moskva to the port of Lisboa, and on. Schultz had had other children, but they had died in the first hard years on Victoria. Only Sasha, last born, Victoria born, had lived, and had fathered a son, and seen him die. He never talked, only sometimes to her, to Luge.
I saw a queer thing, Luge.
What?
An animal.
He pointed to the right, up the steep slope of brush and trees, a dark wall now in the fading light.
There's a bit of a clearing up there where a couple of big trees went down and cleared some room.
Found some aloes at one end of it and was picking them. Looked over my shoulder. Felt something watching. It was at the far end of the clearing.
He paused a minute, not for effect, but to order his description.
It was gathering aloes, too. I thought it was a man at first, like a man. But it wasn't much bigger than a coney when it went down on all fours. Dark-colored, with a reddish head, a big head, seemed too big for the rest of it. A center eye, like a watsit, looking at me. Eyes on the sides, too, I think, but I couldn't see it clear enough. It stared a minute, and then it turned and went into the trees. His voice was low and even.
It sounds frightening, Luge said quietly. I don't know why.
But she did know why, thinking of her dream of the beings who came and watched, though she had not had the dream since they were in the scrublands. Sasha shook his head. They were squatting side by side under a rough roof of branches. He rubbed the beaded rain off his hair, rubbed down his bristling gray mustache.
There's nothing here will hurt us, he said, except ourselves.
Are there any stories in the city about animals we don't know of?
No.
Only the skewers.
Skewers?
Old stories,
Creatures like men with glaring eyes, hairy. My cousin Loris talked about them. My father said they were men, exiles, or men who had wandered off, crazy men, gone wild. Sasha nodded.
Nothing like that would come this far, he said. We're the first.
We've only lived there on the coast. I suppose there are animals we've never seen before.
Plants, too.
See that? It's like what we call whiteberry, but it's not the same. I never saw it until yesterday. Presently, he said, there's no name for the animal I saw.
Luz nodded.
Between her and Sasha was silence, the bond of silence. He did not speak of the animal to others, nor did she. They knew nothing of this world, their world, only that they must walk in it in silence, until they had learned a language fitting to be spoken here. He was one who was willing to wait. The second ridge climbed in a third day of rain, a longer, shallower valley where the going was easier. About midday, the wind turned, blowing down from the north, scouring the ridges free of cloud and mist. All afternoon, they climbed the last slope, and that evening, in a vast, cold clarity of light, they came up among the massive, rusty rock formations of the summit and saw the eastern lands. They gathered there slowly, the slowest still struggling up the stony slope while the leaders stood waiting for them, a few tiny dark figures to the climber's eyes against an immense bright emptiness of sky. The short, sparse grass of the ridgetop glowed ruddy in the sunset. They all gathered there, 67 people, and stood looking out over the rest of the world. They said little. The rest of the world looked very large. The shadows of the ridge they had been climbing stretched a long way across the plain. Beyond those shadows, the land was gold, a hazy, reddish, wintry gold, dimly streaked and mottled with courses of distant streams and the bulk of low hills or ring tree groves. Far across that plateau, at the very edge of the eye's reach, mountains rose against the tremendous, colorless, windy sky. How far? Someone asked. 100 kilometers to the foothills, maybe.
They're big.
Like the ones we saw in the north, over Lake Serene. It may be the same range it ran southeastward.
That plain is like the sea. It goes on and on.
It's cold up here. Let's get down over the summit, out of the wind. Long after the high plains had sunk into gray, the keen, small edge of sunlit ice burned there at the edge of vision in the east. It whitened and faded. The stars came out, thick in the windy blackness, all the constellations, all the bright cities that were not their home. Wild bog rice grew thick by the streams of the plateau. They lived on that during the 8 days of their crossing. The iron hills shrank behind them, a wrinkled, rusty line drawn down the west. The plain was alive with conies, a longer-legged breed than those of the coastal forests. The riverbanks were pocked and hollowed with their warrens, and when the sun was out, the conies came out and sat in the sun and watched the people pass with tranquil, uninterested eyes.
You'd have to be a fool to starve here, Holdfast said, watching Italia lay her snares near a glittering stony ford.
But they went on. The wind blew bitter on that high, open land, and there was no wood to build with or to burn. They went on until the land began to swell, rising toward the foothills of the mountains, and they came to a big river, south-running, which Andre, the mapmaker, named the Grey Rock. To cross it, they must find a ford, which looked unlikely, or build rafts. Some were for crossing, putting that barrier too behind them. Others were for turning south again and going on along the west bank of the river. While they deliberated, they set up their first stopping place camp. One of the men had hurt his foot in a fall, and there were several other minor injuries and troubles. Their footgear needed mending,
They were all weary and needed a few days' rest. They put up shelters of brushwood and thatch leaf the first day. It was cold, with gathering clouds, though the bitter wind did not blow here. That night, the first snow fell. It seldom snowed at Songebay, never this early in the winter. They were no longer in the soft climate of the western coast. The coastal hills, the Badlands, and the Iron Hills caught the rain that came in on the west winds off the sea. Here it would be drier, but colder. The great range toward which they had been walking, the sharp heights of ice, had seldom been visible while they crossed the plain, snow clouds hiding all but the blue foothills. They were in those foothills now, a haven between the windy plain and the stormy peaks. They had entered a narrow stream valley which wound and widened till it opened out on the broad, deep gorge of the Grey Rock. The valley floor was forested, mostly with ring trees and a few thick stands of cotton wools, but there were many glades and clearings among the trees. The hills on the north side of the valley were steep and craggy, sheltering the valley and the lower, open southern slopes. It was a pleasant place. They had all felt at ease there, putting up their shelters the first day. But in the morning, the glades were white, and under the ring trees, though the bronze foliage had kept the light snow off, every stone and leaf of withered grass sparkled with thick frost. The people huddled up to the fires to thaw out before they could go gather more firewood. "Brushwood shelters aren't what we need in this kind of weather," Andre said gloomily, rubbing his stiff, chapped hands.
"Ow, ow, ow, I'm cold."
"It's clearing off," Luge said, looking up through a broad gap in the trees where their side valley opened out into the river gorge. Above the steep farther shore of the Grey Rock, the eastern range glittered hugely, dark blue and white.
"For now, it'll snow again."
Andre looked frail, hunched there by the fire that burned almost invisible in the fresh morning sunlight. Frail, cold, discouraged. Luge, much rested by the day without walking, felt a freshness of spirit like the morning light. She felt a great love for Andre, the patient, anxious man. She squatted down beside him by the fire and patted his shoulder.
"This is a good place, isn't it?" she said.
He nodded, hunched up, still rubbing his sore, red hands.
"Andre," he grunted, "maybe we should be building cabins, not shelters."
"Here?"
"It's a good place."
He looked around at the high red trees, the stream rushing loudly down toward the Grey Rock, the sunlit, open slopes to the south, the great blue heights eastward.
"It's all right," he said grudgingly. "Plenty of wood and water, anyhow. Fish, conies. We could last out the winter here."
"Maybe we should, while there's time to put up cabins?"
Hunched up, his arms hanging between his knees, Andre mechanically rubbed his hands. She watched him, her hand still on his shoulder.
"It would suit me," he said at last.
"If we've come far enough."
"We'll have to get everybody together. Agree."
He looked at her. He put his arm up around her shoulders. They squatted side by side, linked, rocking a little on their heels, close to the quivering, half-seen fire.
"I've had enough running," he said.
"Have you?" She nodded.
"I don't know. I wonder..."
"What?"
Andre stared at the sunlit fire, his face, drawn and weather-beaten, flushed by the heat.
"They say when you're lost, really lost, you always go in a circle," he said. "You come back to where you started from, only you don't always recognize it."
"This isn't the city," Luge said, "nor the town."
"No, not yet."
"Not ever," she said, her brows drawn down straight and harsh. "This is a new place, Andre. A beginning place."
"God willing."
"I don't know what God wants,"
She put out her free hand and scratched up a little of the damp, half-frozen earth and squeezed it in her palm. "That's God," she said, opening her hand on the half-molded sphere of black dirt. "That's me, and you, and the others, and the mountains. We're all... it's all one circle."
"You've lost me, Luge."
"I don't know what I'm talking about. I want to stay here, Andre."
"Then I expect we will," Andre said, and thumped her between the shoulders. "Would we ever have started, I wonder, if it hadn't been for you?"
"Oh, don't say that, Andre."
"Why not? It's the truth."
"I have enough on my conscience without that. I have... if I..."
"This is a new place, Luge," he said very gently. "The names are new here."
She saw there were tears in his eyes.
"This is where we build the world," he said. "Out of mud."
Eleven-year-old Asher came toward Luge, who was down on the bank of the gray rock gathering freshwater mussels from the icy, weed-fringed rocks of a backwater.
"Luge,"
he said when he was near enough not to have to speak loudly.
"Look."
She was glad to straighten up and get her hands out of the bitter cold of the water. "What have you got there?"
"Look,"
the boy said in a whisper, holding out his open hand. On the palm sat a little creature like a shadow-colored toad with wings. Three gold pinhead eyes stared unwinking, one at Asher, two at Luge.
"What's it? I never saw one close up before. He came to me. I was coming down here with the baskets, and he flew into one, and I put out my hand, and he got onto it.
Would he come to me?"
"I don't know. Hold out your hand."
She put her hand beside Asher's. The Watsit trembled and for a moment blurred into a mere vibration of fronds or feathers. Then, with a hop or flight too quick for the eye to follow, it transferred itself to Luge's palm, and she felt the grip of six warm, tiny, wiry feet.
"Oh, you are beautiful," she said softly to the creature. "You are beautiful. And I could kill you, but I couldn't keep you, not even hold you."
"If you put them in a cage, they die," the child said.
"I know," Luge said.
The Watsit was now turning blue, the pure azure blue of the sky between the peaks of the eastern range on days like this day of winter sunlight. The three gold pinhead eyes glittered. The wings, bright and translucent, shot out, startling Luge. Her hand's slight movement launched the little creature on its upward glide, out over the breadth of the river, eastward, like a fleck of mica on the wind. She and Asher filled the baskets with the heavy, bearded, black mussel shells and trudged back up the pathway to the settlement.
"South wind!" Asher cried, tugging his heavy basket along. "Southwind, there's Watsits here. One came to me."
"Of course there are," Southwind said, trotting down the path to help them with their load.
"What a lot you got. Oh, Luge, your poor hands. Come on, the cabin's warm. Sasha brought a new load of wood in on the cart. Did you think there wouldn't be Watsits here? We're not that far from home."
The cabins, nine so far, three more half-built, stood on the south bank of the stream where it widened out onto a pool under the branches of a giant single ring tree. They took their water from the little falls at the head of the pool, bathed and washed at the foot of it where it narrowed before its long plunge down to the gray rock. They called the settlement Heron, or Heron Pool, for the pair of gray creatures who lived on the farther shore of the stream, untroubled by the presence of the human beings, the smoke of their fires, the noise of their work, their coming and going, the sound of their voices. Elegant, long-legged, silent, the herons went about their own business of food gathering on the other side of the wide, dark pool. Sometimes they paused in the shallows to gaze at the people with clear, quiet, colorless eyes. Sometimes, on still, cold evenings before snow, they danced, as Luge and South Wind and the child turned aside toward their cabin. Luge saw the herons standing near the roots of the great tree, one poised to watch them, the other with its narrow head turned back as it gazed into the forest. "They'll dance tonight," she said under her breath, and she stopped a moment, standing with her heavy load on the path, still as the herons, then went on. The End. This is Christina Moore. We hope you have enjoyed this production of The Eye of the Heron by Ursula K. Le Guin. Recorded books are available wherever audiobooks are sold, including Audible.com, Audiobooks.com, Google Play, Apple iTunes, and in public libraries through RB Digital. Thank you for being a Recorded Books reader.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.